Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Science and Media Centre background briefing on biowaste and the research underway here and internationally looking at contaminants in biowaste. Before we begin, can I just get everyone to look to the panel on the left of the screen? You'll see a little four-digit PIN there. If you could just enter that PIN into your phone handset now, followed by the pound sign, that will sync up the audio and the web part of the presentation. We'll be able to see everyone who's on board. That'd be great. So we have three speakers today who will speak for 5 to 7 minutes each and present slides. You'll see the slides in front of you through the web browser. After the presentation, we'll open things up for Q&A. So let me introduce our speakers. Dr. Tom Spear has worked for 40 years as a soil biochemist, first at DSIR, at the Soil Bureau there, then at Landcare Research, and more latterly at ESR. His main research interest over the last 10 years has been the effects of soil biota and biological processes of the heavy metals in land-applied biosolids, in other words, sewage sludge. He's a member of the technical committee overseeing the development of the New Zealand Guidelines for Land Application of Biosolids, published in 2003, and a draft MFE Biosolids Standard. Dr. Susan Jobling is an experienced environmental scientist with over 10 years' experience in research and consultancy. She works with the UK government and other foreign governments and their agencies, as well as with academic institutions and industries, and she acts as an external assessor for the Swiss National Programme on endocrine disruption. Susan has a wide array of ongoing research projects in this area and a particular interest in endocrine disruption, as her early research findings were instrumental in this field. Susan's here to present at a workshop on biowaste contaminants being held tomorrow at ESR. Dr. Grant Northcott is a senior scientist at Plant and Food Research based in Hamilton, where he manages the Food and Biological Chemistry Lab and PFR's organic contaminants research activities in general. Grant previously worked for NIWA in Hamilton and the Institute of Environmental and Biological Sciences in Lancaster in the UK. That's where he obtained his PhD. He's co-authored reports on organic contaminants and sewage sludge for the UK Department of Environment, Transport and Regions and the New Zealand Ministry for the Environment. Over the last year, 5 years, he's been developing a New Zealand capability in emerging contaminant research, identifying sources, concentration and fates of endocrine disrupting compounds. So I'll hand over to Tom now to start the briefing.
Yes, good morning. I'm going to give you a brief background of what our research team is working on and why, and the new areas we're just getting into. Then I'll hand over to our experts in these areas, Susan and Grant. Our research focuses biosolids, which, as Peter said, is treated is sewage sludge, but in fact is treated sewage sludge. The purpose of sewage treatment is to produce clean water, and to do this, the solids are concentrated and separated out, and they carry most of the organic matter and also heavy metal, microbial and organic contaminants. This is the sludge, this is the sewage sludge, but further treatment such as heat drying or anaerobic digestion turns this into biosolids, and this is something that we can utilise. 90% of New Zealand biosolids are landfilled or used to rehabilitate land, and it's usually land that has been a landfill, so to cap the landfill. This compares pretty unfavourably with what goes on in the rest of the world. In the USA, Europe and Australia, more than 40% of biosolids are applied to agricultural land. And there is growing national and international momentum for sustainable waste management, and landfilling is not regarded as being sustainable. So we really are in a situation where we need to do better in terms of our biosolids usage. Biosolids packed with nutrients and valuable organic matter, and organic matter is precious. We lose 200 to 300 million tonnes of topsoil from erosion every year in New Zealand, and this is probably the highest of any country in the world for, per square kilometre. And biosolids reuse, that gives us the opportunity to replenish a small amount of this and also to reduce our reliance on increasingly expensive nutrients. On to the second slide. The focus of our research to date has been on the fate and effects of heavy metals and microbial contaminants, and on nutrient supply and losses, and on plant growth after land application of biosolids. So to be able to put biosolids back onto land, we must understand the risks posed by the contaminants, and to use biosolids in a way that minimises this risk but maximises the benefits. Biosolids are a valuable resource, and it's widely recognised internationally. And over the 10 years or so that we've been working on biosolids, we've made major contributions to guidelines governing the quality and quantity of biosolids that can be applied to land in New Zealand. We have just commenced a new research program which combines most of New Zealand's expertise in biosolids research. Through this program, we've formed a partnership between ESR, Scion and Landcare Research, and we also include other subcontractors, including Plant and Food Research. And a major thrust of this program is around emerging organic contaminants. This is an area that we're just really getting into. And the sorts of contaminants we're talking about here are those contained in pharmaceuticals and personal care products and various other things that have never really been studied before. The impacts of some of these compounds have been studied in aquatic environments, but we know very little about their effects when biosolids are applied to land. Do they break down rapidly or persist? Do they affect soil biota? And can they be taken up by plants or animals? These are things that there's been very little research in these areas and around the world so far. So, to help us kickstart our research in this area, we applied for an ESR International Fellowship to bring one of the world's most prestigious scientists working in these emerging organic contaminants to New Zealand. And this year's fellow is Dr. Susan Jobling from the Ecotoxicology Research Group at the Institute for Environment at Brunel University in the UK. She's an internationally recognised environmental scientist who works closely with both UK and foreign governments, academic institutions and industries. And her research involves protecting water environments, especially in relation to emerging organics and especially endocrine disrupting chemicals. And the two primary purposes of bringing Susan to New Zealand are firstly to help us select appropriate chemicals for study, help us design experimental approaches that we'll use for the study. And using her expertise, we will look at which new and emerging contaminants are of most concern and how we could investigate these and how these interact with soil biota and affect soil health and fertility. And then secondly, to use Susan's international reputation to run a workshop, which we're holding here tomorrow, developing a New Zealand strategy for emerging contaminant issues for regulators, industry and researchers. And this also allows us to put our research initiatives in front of our stakeholders. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Susan to talk about these issues.
Thanks, Tom. Good morning, everybody. As Tom said, my area of expertise is really in the contaminants themselves, and particularly the ecotoxicology surrounding these chemicals, particularly endocrine disrupting chemicals. But endocrine disrupting chemicals are really only one group of a whole range of emerging substances of concern. And the list includes the global organic contaminants, which include polybrominated flame retardants, pharmaceuticals and personal care products, as Tom mentioned, the drugs that you buy over the counter, which we've only just got sufficient expertise at measuring those contaminants in the environment at the low levels at which they're present. And also things contained in shampoos and cosmetics as well are included in that group. But I'm going to focus a little bit on endocrine disrupting chemicals because we've done a lot of research on these in the UK. Oh, I've gone backwards. Apologies. Okay, right. So, endocrine disrupting contaminants. Endocrine disrupting contaminants are not a particular group of contaminants. All of those groups that I described to you before, an endocrine disrupting contaminant could be in any one of those groups, because the definition of an endocrine disruptor is that it will interfere with the endocrine system. The endocrine system is the body's chemical hormone signaling system. And as you can see on this picture, we have a number of endocrine glands around our bodies, and the hormones are the signaling molecules that are passed between the glands, delivering important messages about function, body function. And so an endocrine disruptor, by mimicking or interfering with the action of a hormone, can interfere with reproduction, development, growth, appetite, immunity, brain function, and also metabolism. So almost anything, really. A simple example, if we move to the aquatic environment, which is where the UK has been quite famous for working in this area, is actually in the looking at fish. And an example would be an estrogenic contaminant. An estrogenic contaminant could interfere with reproductive function in fish. And these were first discovered when male fish were found to be producing a female-specific yolk protein, vitlogenin. Now, in females, they normally make estrogen. The ovary makes estrogen. It's carried by the blood to the liver, where it interacts with estrogen receptors in a sort of lock and key mechanism, the receptor being the lock and the estrogen being the key. So the key goes into the lock, turns it, and causes the production of this estrogen responsive gene, vitlogenin, which is then carried back by the blood to the ovary, where it's sequestered by the growing eggs in the ovary, causes the ovary to grow. Male fish, of course, wouldn't normally produce estrogen, so they would not normally produce vitlogenin. They do, however, have estrogen receptors in their liver. So if there's an estrogen in the aquatic environment and it's taken in to their bodies through their gills or through food, then it can cause the production of vitlogenin. Of course, there is no ovary to send the vitlogenin to, so very high levels of vitlogenin in the blood of male fish can actually cause kidney failure, because it can constitute up to 50% of the blood protein. Vitlogenin is a very good biomarker, has proved to be a very good biomarker almost everywhere in the world now for exposure of fish to estrogens. Some of these estrogens are contained in the contraceptive pill, and some are natural estrogens that women excrete. Okay. But in addition to the steroid estrogens, which are 17-beta-estradiol, estrone, and 17-alpha-ethanol-estradiol, the one in the contraceptive pill, there are also a whole plethora of man-made chemicals which mimic the action of estrogen. They fool the body into thinking that they are hormones. These include nonylphenol, which is widely used actually here in New Zealand and in Australia. It's been banned in Europe since 2005. It's an estrogen mimic, and it's found in quite high quantities in sewage effluents and in sludge. It's one of a number of biodegradation products of alkylphenolic surfactants, which are used widely in industrial detergents. Octalphenol, a related compound. And then there are the phthalates, which are a whole range of plasticizers. They are of particular interest in Europe at the moment, connected with endocrine disruption in humans, or possibly causing endocrine disruption in humans. And they actually interfere with the synthesis of hormones, the synthesis of testosterone, the male hormone. So they actually feminize in that way rather than directly interacting with the receptors, the sex hormone receptors themselves. And then there are a number of others, including a whole range of pesticides and herbicides and PCBs. Many of these are weak estrogens compared with steroid estrogens, but what we're concerned about here is that whilst individually they may not cause effects, when they're put together, their effects are often additive, and so the level of exposure could be greater than if you were exposed to one of those compounds on its own. They also, many of them, bioaccumulate and bioconcentrate. So the policy concerns really in Europe and in England have concerning endocrine disruptors have been that they elicit toxicity without being inherently toxic. They have the potential to impact all biological systems at very, very low concentrations. And the other concern is latency, that the gap between their exposure to these chemicals and their effects could be a generation or two. Often we're exposed to these chemicals or animals are in utero and the effects are not manifest until the animal undergoes puberty. Real-world exposure, as I mentioned before, involves exposure to mixtures of endocrine-disrupting chemicals that, like other synthetic chemicals, can be cumulative or have synergistic effects. So there's a real significance of these chemicals for both chemical and water policy. Now, I call these new kids on the block the pharmaceuticals and personal care products. And I mentioned those before right at the beginning of the talk. These are, as Tom said, chemicals which we know very little about. We know very little about what their effects are and whether they move up the food chain and whether they can be passed into our cells through consuming foods that may be growing on sludge amend in soils, for example. We do know that they are... Some of the drugs, particularly pain relievers, are those that are found in the highest concentrations. So we have done some measurements on these. And we know that some of them can induce estrogenic effects. So in that sense, they are endocrine-disrupting chemicals. But most of the research that has been done, and there's been very little done at the moment, that these effects are not likely at the current environmental concentrations. But as I alluded to earlier, most of these tests have been done on single compounds, and they usually occur as mixtures. So mixture toxicity is a real area for future research on these chemicals, and it's necessary in order for us to understand whether the uptake of these chemicals is actually of concern, health concern to us. And just to mention now at the end of my sort of soundbite, the UK-Australia Collaborative Network, I've been over here now for, I'm in my third week, I think, and over the last few years I've been having a dialogue with Australia on forming a collaborative network on emerging contaminants. Emerging contaminants in water and in soil, really those that arise as a consequence of the processing of waste. And it's an opportunity here to address common policy challenges. They're common throughout the world, these environmental problems, through a joint research response. And so what we're looking to do is try and exploit the complementary strengths of different national research programs so that we can achieve a really critical mass to fund large-scale projects in this area. And one of the reasons for being here in New Zealand is to invite New Zealand to join us in our collaborative network. And I'll now hand over to Grant, who's going to continue.